Mateus, welcome to the podcast. I'm pumped to be chatting today. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lloyd. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Let's start with a quick explanation of what Tint is and what you do there, right? I interview a lot of people more closely related to things I know a lot about, and insurance, and specifically embedded insurance, does not fit into the category of things I know much about. So rather than me trying to introduce it poorly, I'd like for you to take over for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So embedded insurance is definitely not a household topic or think people don't think about it, but in a way is by design, right? The embedded insurance is really trying to make insurance a feature and not a product. So make sure that whenever people use a service, they buy something, that insurance protection comes with that. They don't even have to think about it. So in a sense, if embedded insurance succeeds, as we think it will, consumers don't have to think about insurances anymore for most part. So think about you want to ship your car from New York to San Francisco, and you work with you use a website called UShip, which is one of our customers. As part of the flow, as you're booking the dates and things like that, you're going to see a screen to say, do you want to add protection for $50 to that transaction? It's as easy as clicking yes, you're covered. If something were to break, if your cars get stolen in transit, if there is an accident, whatever, you're covered. So that's really the fancy name embedded insurance means nothing but the insurance that comes with stuff that you buy and rent or services you use.
So then as a business, what you do is you help a company like UShip make that offer to their customers very easily and in a seamless way, because it'd be difficult for them to offer that by themselves.
Yeah. So as easy as we want to make it the experience and the UX, it is extremely complicated. Insurance is very regulated. So what Tint does is that we provide this end-to-end platform that brands and companies can go and create their own embedded protection product. So we provide all the technology, all the systems, and keep track of things and payments and things like that. All the service layers, so calculating pricing, adjusting claims, and fixing things, and the risk transfer, the capital. So the companies don't have to take this risk on their balance sheet if they don't want to. So from their perspective, we're really an end-to-end solution to help them create their own embedded protection products.
Very cool. And you've been at this for a little over 5 years now. And
that's
did
right.
You start it at all without raising money, or do you raise money on day one?
We raised money on day one. So my background is I worked for Turo as the car sharing company as one of the early employees. That's where I met my co-founder, Jerome. We worked together for about 4 years, and we decided to get out, or start Tint to create the product we wish existed while we were at Turo. So we were indirectly working with Turo's insurance product. So when you rent a car at Turo, at some point you have the option to just buy protection as part of the rental. So that was really an inspiration for us, but also we saw how hard it was for the company to create those products to scale without having a proper help, like having to build everything in-house. It was a very painful experience. And therefore, we got out to start this product. And, it was part of the journey, and we raised money from day one, because by the time we left, we had built our network. My former boss, the CEO of Turo, was our first check. His former boss was our first institutional check. So we were really tied into the, I'd say, Turo/eBay kind of ecosystem. And yeah, we raised about $500,000 before we got started.
At what point did you decide to do YC?
Well, YC was kind of almost 3 years down the road. So we went through a lot of explorations we always had the same vision, the same direction, but obviously our vision, again, making insurance a feature, not a product, is extremely broad, and there are many things that need to happen for this simple idea to work. So we started trying a few different angles on how to build our first product. So the first product was an AI-powered score to assess risk in real time. So our idea was that if you want to do those online insurance experiences, you're renting a car at Turo, we need to quickly know who you are, what you're renting, and give you a risk score and give you a pricing that is personalized. So that was our first product. So we explored that in a couple of years. And eventually we expanded to the end-to-end infrastructure that I mentioned. And that was the time we decided in full transparency, we applied for YC 3 times before we got in. So we got in the third time. So I would say it's more or less that we decided to go to YC and more that they finally accepted when we had the end-to-end infrastructure kind of concept.
Were you part of an in-person cohort for YC?
No, we were part of Winter 21. So it was already a full remote, but I would say it was the third remote they'd done. So by the time we were doing, I think it was very smooth. I think the two cohorts before had, I think from what I heard, a bit more a learning curve. When it got 2 hours, it was pretty smooth sailing.
What would you say the biggest benefits or changes that you made were as a result of being in the program? Like, how did that change the direction of the company?
I think YC accelerates things. I think it gives you an exposure to, I mean, there are two main things I would say for us. One is like acceleration. So there's a 12-week process. And the day you get accepted, which is say about a couple of months before, a month and a half before the program starts, as they say, YC started, right? The day you get the yes, you know when the demo date's going to be, you have that combined, 16 to 20 weeks to use your chance, right? Use your chance in the spotlight. And that pressure, it's amazing what it does, right? So again, we've been running that, as I mentioned, for about 2.5 years before. Of course, we're trying to move fast. But when you have something like that, it helps accelerate. That's one thing. And then there's the pressure for other peers, not in a bad way, but you're seeing people making progress. So it's a little bit a pretty powerful force. And the other thing I would say from YC that I really enjoyed is that you hear, even if virtually, kind of very amazing founders tell their story and tell their real story and not the PR story. So you see that the most successful companies or startups in the world went through very hard times and they were in near-death experiences, all of them, right? So it helps us as a founder realize that the journey is hard for everyone. And if I'm not already in an amazing part of the journey, doesn't mean that I'm not going to make it. And I'll say the sad news is that it's never going to get easy because even when you're a public company, when you quote unquote made it, there are different problems. Like, as a founder, you're always dealing with growth, with problems, and it's part of the job. And I think YC helps crystallize that very well.
What's been your approach to taking a long, big, kind of multi-year vision and breaking that into, not necessarily daily things to work on daily, but in terms of okay, we know we have this really big North Star. How did you convert that into an actual, go to market and series sequences of logical, okay, we'll do this first, then that'll position us for X, then that'll do that for X. Is that something that was a skill that you already had? Because that's something I find is very difficult for me, is thinking, okay, way ahead, what could this turn into? Okay, what do we do based on that today, tomorrow, this quarter? Because be where you want to be 10 years from now tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's very hard. And I think we got better at it, but I don't think we were always good, right? I think we heard very early days, and one of the few weeks of our company, as we were pitching people what we want to build, we heard something that never gonna, this stuck with us, which is you're kind of building 5 companies in one, which is when you get the feedback that hey, that's great. I get the vision, but man, you're not going to be able to execute it all, right? So how do you break it out? And I think we broke, as I mentioned, through this score, the risk score was our first way to break. Because again, if you think of the overall arch end to end, this is pricing and underwriting is a small piece of the entire story. So we're if we can get very good at it, we expand from it. I think we did expand. So that part worked. But it was not based on success in a sense, right? We sold our score for a few customers. It paid and financed us for a couple of years. We were really bootstrapping until we raised our seed and our Series A. So it, it had its purpose, but I wouldn't say that like our vision has been linearly step by step, and each step is being very successful. So the next one is in a high. And so it's been a bit of a zigzag, if you will. So, but I think it's a normal startup job, right? Like I think very few founders, if any, will tell you that they had this like straight line connection to vision and they follow like dot by dot, because it's likely that you're going to have, you know, pitfalls and then change direction, but come back. But it's very important to keep the North Star going, because no, as a founder, like what prevents us from getting our money and opening a lemonade factory or whatever crazy things that are completely unrelated to the mission and the vision? The answer is nothing prevents you, right? So that's why it's important to grow. We start every company meeting with our vision and our mission. And I'm sure that, no, it's kind of repetitive in a way, but it is on purpose, right? It's like every time. And it really kind of guides our decisions in terms of product, in terms of team, in terms of like, you know, what to do next.
That's a bit of a subject matter question. What classifies something properly as insurance and like a proper classification versus an insurance-like product? So for example, like I have a friend of mine who has a chocolate company. This is going to sound hypothetical, but I have a friend who sells chocolate on Shopify and he sells something he calls melt insurance, right? Where if your chocolate melts, when it arrives, he'll do whatever. And I don't think that's actually an insurance product, but like what is, and I gather that what you're dealing with is like, no, you're setting up a properly compliant, you can use the word insurance and you're not, it's not, what makes something properly insurance?
So we have both. We work with insurance and we work with what we call assurance, which is your point of insurance-like product. That's probably a very complicated legal answer. And we spend the best part of the last 2 years kind of really understanding that and the nuances. So the short answer is it's complicated. But if I give you the chart, maybe a oversimplified answer is, you know, typically the insurance-like are insurance is full standalone. And so I mean, anybody who has a license can sell insurance for anything to everyone. The insurance like has a lot of less of the compliance and kind of regulatory hurdles, but it has to be for the most part related to something you're doing. So for example, tourist insurance is not insurance for the most part. It is insurance like product. Why? Because you rent a car, like that car being damaged, being stolen, you are on the hook. So what Turo is selling you is an insurance-like product that say, hey, you are on the hook for the car, but if you pay me $50, I will let you off the hook. And then you pay. So again, it's more like it's more on the legal part from a customer, from an end user perspective. They behave similarly, like they pay for losses. Like saying if the chocolate melts, to your point, they get a new one. Like that is a type of kind of guarantee from that they're selling to their users. But I'll tell you, gets complicated. And that's one of the beauties of this market.
I guess the root of my question is from the company's point of view, why would it matter to have a properly legally compliant insurance product versus to just offer an insurance? Like why would a company take the effort to have the compliant version?
I mean, the insurance-like version, for the records, like should be compliant and should have the same protections of insurance, right? Because think about insurance at the end of the day, it's a promise. I can promise to pay you $10 million. And if there's no regulation, like how do you know if I'm going to come and honor the promise whenever I have to pay you, right? So all the insurance regulation is about protecting consumers against fraud and against companies that don't have money to pay that when the time comes. So when we design insurance-like products, we're designing with those principles in mind, because we don't want your point. We don't want the chocolate company to not have money because, you know, it turns out that every single chocolate melts. They lose money in every transaction. They go out of business. And now a lot of people are kind of lost their chocolate and they're never going to see their money back. Right? So that obviously chocolate is a simple example, but that could be, as I mentioned, your car that you rent out to Turo, could be the car that you ship at a website. Now we could be talking about, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars here. So the company should always do the compliant way. Now, why they would do the insurance like it's lighter in regulations, but comes with some constraints as well. You cannot do many use cases. So it does not right and wrong. I think it depends on what the company's strategy is.
For companies that, don't know that you exist, is your pitch to them an opportunity to make more money as a result of like having something that's opted in on more frequently than it's to be paid out? Or it's more of a, you just need to have this to cover your downside in the events of XYZ?
We typically pitch as a growth lever because, if they need insurance to exist, they probably already have it and they know, so they're protecting the upsides. I think for us, it's typically a growth enabler because if the business has some intrinsic risk, so the shipping example, cars can break while shipping. It's just like there's a percentage of them that will break, right? So some people may not ship cars because they're afraid it's going to break and what happens. So if you offer the protection, you remove this risk from the heads of the consumer. You can make a little bit more money from that. But more importantly, you convert. So the conversion of a car business goes up. So the magic of embedded insurance happens when that insurance protection make your business more valuable. Because then you sell more of your car business and you have a new profit center from insurance. And the further we go from this logic, the more nice to have it becomes, like if you will. So for example, suppose you're waiting in line in your bank and somebody from the bank comes and offers health insurance. Like in theory, they could. You're there, you have time, you're on the hook as a customer, but health insurance has nothing to do with banking services. So there's absolutely no reason why you would buy from the bank versus from looking at Google. So that's an example where probably that tactics wouldn't work.
What does your company do relative to the landscape of cyber insurance? Right, I have a cousin who works in insurance, and I shared with him your website and all the stuff about your company in prep for this interview. And that was what he was most curious to have me learn from about you, was kind of traditional cyber insurance and where you all fit into that ecosystem.
We don't have any cyber product off the shelf now, but I think the closest we can get from cyber, or we have from cyber, is we work with a company called Quantstam, and we help them offer this performance guarantee. So what they do is that they screen DeFi or decentralized finance platforms. So if they find vulnerabilities, they produce a report. And then basically what we're doing is like we attach protection to this report, meaning if they told you that's safe and you put money and the platform gets hacked and you end up losing your money, they will pay, right? Because it means that their report didn't work. So this is not a typical cyber product, but it's an example of what we call a performance guarantee that applies for kind of cyber kind of hacks and things like that. But no, the way we think about cyber is like, hey, if we have a great company that wants to do that, our typical sales process, they come to us an idea, we do our internal diligence, kind of build a business case. If we're comfortable that works, they are comfortable that works, and we go and build that to them, and then we can go sell similar products to other companies on that space.
So as the CEO, 5 years in, again, you raised a Series A, I forget how long ago, but it was a big one, maybe in the last 1 to 2 years. What are you focused on kind of on a daily basis? Because it's not like a small team anymore by, I guess, my standards of a small team.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit larger than it was before, for sure. So things have already changed. I mean, as a CEO, I focus a lot on growth. And focus a lot on team, right? Like your point that there's no longer 5 people in a room trying to figure it out. This is a bit more of a process, hiring, attracting the right talent, motivating them, training them. And we do something that is kind of, as we started this conversation, somewhat like obscure, like most people don't have insurance experience. So really trying to kind of educate and train them is a big part of what we do. And growth, I think for any venture-backed startup or CEO, it's always going to be top of mind. Obviously, growth today, it's more responsible growth than it has been. So growth at all costs is no longer a viable strategy for most companies, even venture-backed ones. But no, growing, like as a venture-backed, you got to grow 2, 3, 5 times a year. That's a little bit of the expectation.
Why did you decide to make this a remote first company?
I mean, in our case, it was lack of choice, but it ended up being great because my co-founder is French. So while we're starting in San Francisco, he told me like, yeah, I'm going back to Paris for personal family reasons. And we had two choices. Either we made remote work in 2018, when people thought it was the craziest ideas, there were investors that wouldn't talk with us because we were remote. Either we do that or we'll have to find another co-founder or we have to work on different things. And we basically made it work. So I'm glad we went down this path before it was popular, I guess.
So do you personally work from home most days?
I do. I work from home. I have my little office here in my house. I'm on the road a lot, and like, you know, especially now post COVID and conferences, customer prospect meetings. But whenever I'm not traveling, I work from home.
That's very interesting. Again, to tell someone 10 years ago, it's like, you know, the CEO of a successful like venture backed company that's doing well, and I work from home every day. It's like, what? This wouldn't compute for some people.
Yeah, work from home. And I think we talked before the call from Las Vegas, which is not an obvious place for most startup founders. And again, that's the beauty of remote, right? Let's each person pick what's the place that, you know, maximizes value to them, not what the company wants, right? And no, really, and we have people in many different countries. It kind of really unlocks the talent pool that you can think about. So it creates other complexities or management complexities, of course. But I believe that if you have your operating system as a company designed for remote, you can make it work. It's just a different operating system than an office company. And typically companies get in trouble when they have a full office DNA, they have no idea how to work remote, and they want to do it. Like, that's not going to work, right? It's the wrong framework.
So at the beginning of your career, let's say when you're, you know, coming out of school, was your longer term intention to be a venture backed founder, or when did that kind of come into your mind as what you wanted to be doing?
Yes. I mean, from early age, I can't recall 10 years old or something. I was one of this kind of quintessential, like, you know, lemonade stand kid that always thinking about small businesses and these little hacks and things like that. So yeah, I always knew I wanted to be a founder. I mean, it took me a while, to be honest, between college and I went to consulting and business school. And then, but I think I jumped on the opportunity as soon as I thought that I had the right toolkit to do it.
What is your opinion on business school as a worthwhile or necessary piece of kind of your background that's positioned you for the things you're doing well?
It's not necessary, but I believe was one of the best experiences of my life. So, you know, as again, go back to Peter Thiel's view, like, arguably, you don't even need college, right? You can just, as a teenager, start jumping on startups. I think that that's going to be, now, if you just want to focus in your very narrow startup success, it might be a viable option. But I think in a business school, the same as college, like, builds to me beyond skills, right? Builds relationships. I mean, you have a great time. So that's something that is intangible, but I believe it's super important. And, you know, and de-risks, I'd say, your life, right? So if you go to business school and you jump in a startup, 2-3 doesn't work, you always have jobs available for you. So it's almost like your downside is fully protected. So anyway, my point of view, it's a great product. I don't regret it, and I would recommend it to everyone, but it's not required. Like, no, there was a joke in Silicon Valley that, I don't know if it's true, but back in the day, when you were evaluating or putting value to a young startup, you add $1 million for each engineer and you reduce $500,000 from every MBA. That's just the joke. I don't think it's true anymore, but like, it just tells you that, yeah, it's not required.
That's funny. I like that. I'm going to find a way to repeat that in some situation. I like how two things you said there. One, it's a product, business school. It's not viewing it as an abstract thing. That's like, oh, what is this kind of nebulous concept? It's a product with features and benefits and costs associated and timelines. And there's a set of outcomes that make it worthwhile and a set of outcomes where maybe it doesn't make as much sense. So I think that's very measured and thoughtful. And then I like that you also said an important aspect of it. It was just a fun part of life. And that's, you know, this is a very serious podcast a lot of the time, but we do also value enjoying the existence that we have. What is the most fun part of kind of the current stage of the business that you're at for you?
The most fun part, I think, it, to me, is still, again, going back to growth, this is still, like, you know, it's a daily battle because we're so far from the potential, right? So again, people expect embedded insurance to become 20, 30, 40% of insurance, which would mean trillions of dollars, right? And we are so far from it as a category, not only tint, but the entire category, that is still fun and exciting to figure out how to make that happen. It's not obvious, right? It's not coming without a lot of hard work. So I think, like, no, I'm really kind of energized by talking to customers, hearing their pain points, sometimes I'm being wrong about some hypotheses we had and discovering why we're wrong and like, what should we do next? So that is by far the most fun part of my kind of startup journey. It was before and continues to be the case.
This is two questions. It's the same question, just two different parts. So you can do one and then the other if you don't want to keep them both in your mind at the same time. What is something that you wish you knew in year one of the business that you know now, either about the market or just about kind of being a successful operator slash founder? That's part one. I'll save part two for a second.
Yeah. I mean, what I wish I knew is, like, again, that is, I wish I knew the best angle to get started the vision, right? So again, if we think about, we are almost six years, like five and a little bit year old company, but really the product we're selling now, it's about 2 years old. So it took us 3 years to figure it out and kind of go to different tangents. I wish I could have skipped that, but obviously hindsight is 2020.
Mm-hmm. And then secondarily, what is something that you've just learned this year that was really important? So from year 5/6 that going into next year is going to be a big lesson. So that's something you didn't know at the beginning, but now it's something that you learn now that you didn't maybe say no last year at the beginning of this year, that you're like, that's definitely a big, big takeaway from the year.
A big takeaway is that, like, doing related to one of your points about, you know, about team and about the size of the organization, that a 50 people team is radically different from a 20 people team, that is radically different from a 5 people team. And I think it took us a while to understand the motions and get good at this scale. But that was, for me, one of the lessons of this year, when we, like, you know, scaling the team, making sure that, you know, everybody's working the same things, understand where we're going, they can change when we need to change. So that was, like, you know, this kind of HR leadership piece, I think, was the biggest learning for us as an organization this year.
This is one of my favorite questions for people who are very busy and very committed to their current thing. Let's say you had a clone, or you suddenly had 30 more hours per week and all of your existing obligations were taken care of. What are other exciting things, maybe completely out of scope, that you're like, if I was two of me, the second me would be going after this right now, this opportunity?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, I can think about 10 different things. So as a founder, I like to see different things. I have a lot of interest. So definitely I can look at a few things. I think, you know, two things I would definitely look closely. It's technology and software for remote work, like how make remote teams better. Because now you have Asana, you have those things that are basic that remote teams can use in Slack. But I don't think there's a good remote OS just yet that can help you figure out processes and other things in the company. And the other one is like energy. And again, being in Vegas, I never thought about energy before. But here you're bombarded with, like, no solar and all those things, and obviously climate change happening. I'll definitely spend more time understanding why is that Las Vegas is not 100% powered by solar energy, and frankly, Nevada or the west of the United States. And as a business, like, what would you need to do to make that happen? Because obviously the world needs, and I bet there's a huge business opportunity there.
I think those are two very, very good ones. Well, we are coming up on time here. What is, at the current stage of Tint, the kind of right persona, like the right size company or the right size thing where it makes sense to actually reach out to you as, like, a genuinely interested person, and or where are you personally active on the internet sharing advice and thoughts and things like this?
Yeah. Well, we're happy to.
What types of people should be looking out to work there?
Yeah, for sure. So we, for first on the persona, like, again, we're happy to talk with anyone and help, even if you're just getting started. Just contact us on the website. Somebody from the team would absolutely answer. But then what is the best persona for us is probably a Series C, Series D marketplace or vertical SaaS startup that has already figured out core business and is looking to add new revenue lines, new services. And that's where we think we fit squarely. In terms of where to find us, obviously our website, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm very active, or us as a company. So those, I think, are the two places that are best to connect with us.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. This was a blast. I think it's an exciting thing, and I'm excited to see where things go and check back in after some time.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.